Hello, and welcome back to the Penn-Faulkner podcast. Today we have an enormous treat for you. Deborah Eisenberg, short story writer extraordinaire, MacArthur recognized genius, and winner of this year's Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. One of her excellent short stories coming up next.
Good evening. I'm Richard McCann, the president of the board of Penn-Faulkner, and I'm really glad to welcome you to what is the 28th annual Malamud Award, given for excellence in the short story and established by Penn-Faulkner in cooperation with the Malamud family to honor the distinguished legacy of Bernard Malamud as a writer and teacher. The person who's going to welcome you in your program is Susan Richards Shreve, whom I'm delighted to be for this brief moment. Susan suddenly can't make it due to a family problem and has asked me to say some words on her behalf. So what I'm going to say is actually words from Susan, who wants you to know that the Malamud family is here tonight, as always. Bernard's son, Paul Malamud, his daughter, Jana Malamud Smith, herself a writer, his son-in-law, David Smith, and one of their adult children, Peter. We at Penn-Faulkner really love this occasion, with it's warm and personal, and recognizes the spirit and fact, the value of literature to our humanity. I'm here to introduce, Deborah Tannen, who is a member of our board, runs the Malamud Prize. But most particularly, she's a brilliant linguist, essayist, and nonfiction writer of 11 books, a scholar who has democratized the language of relationships in book after book, from women and men in conversation to talking to your parents, partners, sibs, and kids when you're all adults, to sisters in conversation throughout their lives, and many others, including, in progress, a book on friendship. Deborah is herself a great friend to Penn-Faulkner, to literature, and to language, teaching us about the true nature of ordinary conversations in our quotidian lives. Deborah Tannen.
I'm not sure if I should say thank you, Richard, or thank you, Susan. I have an image of myself. It's the mid-80s, sitting in my kitchen, breakfast, cup of coffee, opening that week's New Yorker, and the little leap of excitement in my heart when I saw that that week's table of contents showed there was a story by Deborah Eisenberg in that week. And I can recall the eager anticipation with which I would start reading each of those stories. Since her first published story, it was called Flotsam, appeared in the New Yorker in 1984, Deborah Eisenberg has published 5 collections of short stories. The titles are Transactions in a Foreign Currency, Under the 82nd Airborne, All Around Atlantis, Twilight of the Superheroes, and that was a finalist for the Penn-Faulkner Award in 2007, and the collected stories of Deborah Eisenberg, which won the Penn-Faulkner Award in 2011. So she's no stranger to Penn-Faulkner and to this venue. In 1994, she published a really unusual book, Air 24 Hours. It's a collaboration with a painter in which she comments on each of the paintings. She wrote a play, Pastoral, which was performed in New York before the publication of her first story. And many of you know she's written critical essays in The Atlantic, the New York Review of Books. I could go on, but she's received an avalanche of awards, and I'll mention some of them. Best American Short Story, multiple O. Henry Prizes, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award for Literature, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, a Whiting Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Ray Award for the Short Story, and a MacArthur Genius Grant. When she won that, Tin House noted, "We've been calling her a genius for years. We're thrilled it's finally been made official." Her innovative genius in writing the short story and in furthering the form of the short story has been remarked on again and again. Jean Thompson, writing in the New York Times, credits her with reinventing the short story form. Also in the New York Times, Ben Marcus calls her one of the most important fiction writers now at work. Her stories have been described as, I had so many to pick from, it was really fun, but I'll just read you a few. Exquisitely distilled, rich and delicate, radiant, complex, dense, fierce, and comic, some of the most ambitious and memorable works of fiction in the contemporary literary landscape. One critic observed, Eisenberg conveys her character's interiority in such a fine grain that one thinks of Virginia Woolf, if only Woolf's work were leavened with startling humor. Another said, her stories have the fresh, mixed up, happy, sad texture of real life. She's found words to capture all the fleeting, ambivalent emotion of daily experience. And here's her own observation about finding words in an interview in the Paris Review. She said, a piece of fiction is a communication. You're sending an urgent message in a bottle from your desert island. You hope that somebody's going to find the bottle and open it and say, S-O, I just love that. I love the obliqueness and the whimsy of that, and it just gives you a taste of her use of language. She goes on, but the message that is found cannot be exactly the message you've sent. Whatever bunch of words the writer transmits requires a person, a consciousness on the other end to reassemble it. That's the beauty and the magic of her stories, her invitation to us, her trust in us to reassemble the messages she sends as we hear our own voices in the dialogue of the characters' words that she writes and see ourselves in the scenes that she creates. In accepting an award in 1959, Bernard Malamud expressed the hope, this is a quote, that expert practitioners of the short story, especially those who come rarely, if ever, to the novel, will be recognized in the future. Tonight, it's our pleasure and our honor to recognize just such an expert practitioner, a master of the short story. Please join me in welcoming Deborah Eisenberg.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Deborah. It's really uncanny to be here in this incredible room and to have this wonderful award that recognizes such an under-recognized form and carries the name of a great writer of both short and long fiction. One of the real greats. So thank you so much. Now, I do write short fiction, but it's not short enough. So it's always difficult figuring out what to read. It's very complicated and dense and elaborate. So I decided that rather than trying to fillet something, I would just read you the first chunk of a story. This story is called Your Duck is My Duck. Way back, oh, not all that long ago, actually, just a couple of years, but back before I'd gotten a glimpse of the gears and levers and pulleys that dredge the future up from the Earth's core to its surface, I was going to a lot of parties. And at one of these parties, there was a couple, Ray and Krista, who hung out with various people I sort of knew, or anyhow, whose names I knew. We'd never had much of a conversation, but I'd seen them at parties over the years. And at that particular party, they seemed to forget that we weren't actually friends ourselves. Ray and Krista had a lot of money, a serious quantity, and they were both also very good looking, so they could live the way they felt like living. Ray had a chummy arm around me, and Krista was swaying to the music, which was almost drowned out by the din of voices in the metallic room and smiling absently in my direction. I was a little taken aback that I was being, I guess, anointed, but it was up to them how well they knew you, and I could only assume that their cordiality meant either that something good had happened to me, which was not yet perceptible to me, but was already perceptible to them, or else that something good was about to happen to me. So we were talking, shouting really over the noise, and after a bit, I realized that what they were saying meant that they now owned my painting, Blue Hill. They owned Blue Hill? I had given Blue Hill to Graham once in a happy moment, and he must have sold it to them when he moved to Barcelona. Blue Hill is not a bad painting, in my opinion. It's one of my best. Still, the expression that I could feel taking charge of my face came and went without making trouble for anyone, thanks to the fact that obviously there were a lot of people in the room for Ray and Krista to be looking at other than me. How are you these days, they asked. And at this faint suggestion that they'd been monitoring me, a great wave of childish gratitude and relief washed over me, dissolving my dignity and leaving me stranded in self-pity. Why did I keep going to these stupid parties? Night after night, parties, parties. Was I hoping to meet someone? No one met people in person any longer. You couldn't hear what they were saying. I'm exhausted, I told Ray and Krista. I can't sleep. I can't take the winter. I'm sick of my day job. And as I told them that I was frightened, that I was sick of the winter and my job, I understood how deeply, deeply sick of the winter and my job, how frightened I really was. Yeah, that's terrible, they said. Well, why don't you come stay with us? We're taking off for our beach place on Wednesday. There's plenty of room and you can paint. It's a great place to work. Everyone says so. You'll be inspired. Everyone who visits is inspired. You won't have to deal with anything. There's a cook. You can lie around in the sun. You can take donkey rides down into the town, or there are bicycles, or the driver. What languages do you speak? Well, it doesn't matter. You won't need to speak any. Naturally, I assumed they'd forget all about their invitation, so I was startled the day after the party to get an email from Krista asking when I could get away. One of their people would deal with the flights. A week or so later, a messenger brought a plane ticket up the 5 flights of stairs to my little apartment, which was when it dawned on me that the good thing Ray and Krista had perceived happening to me was that they now owned one of my paintings, which meant, obviously, that it most likely was, or would soon be, worth acquiring. The plane took off in frosty grime, and I floated down across the water from which the sun was rising in sheer pink and yellow flounces. It was a different time here. Must that not mean that different things were happening? I'd brought my laptop, but maybe I could actually just not turn it on, and the dreary growth of little obligations that overran my screen would just disappear. Maybe the news, which, like a magic substance in a fairy tale, was producing perpetually increasing awfulness from rock bottom bad, would just disappear. In the airport, ceiling fans were gracefully turning, and the heat was dry and benign. As everyone exited with their luggage, I kept peering at the email from Krista I'd printed out, which kept saying, "Someone will be waiting to pick you up." I had her cell number on my phone, I remembered, and scrabbled in my purse for it, but as I pressed and tapped different bits of it and stared at its inert face, I was struck by how complete the difference is between a phone that works and a phone that doesn't work. For a long time, whenever I traveled anywhere, it had been with Graham, who would have thought to deal with the issue of international phone service. And as I stood there, a lanky apparition ballooned into the void at my side, frowning, mulling the situation over. Graham! But the apparition tossed back its fair, silky hair, kissed me lightly, and dissipated, leaving me so much more alone than I'd been an instant before. Wheeling my bulging, creaking suitcase here and there as potential disasters stacked up in my mind in great, unstable piles, I swayed on my feet from fatigue. I was deciding which exit to march myself to and then do what when Krista strode up. The driver and Ray got into some big snarl, she said, hustling me along, and he took off. He's acting out all over the place. He's like crashing into stuff, I said. I wasn't managing my suitcase fast enough to keep up with her, and she grabbed it from me irritably. He's buying something. A car? I said. Did you remember to hydrate on the plane? She said. He's buying a subsidiary. It always makes him crazy, but hey, nerves are a weakness. So this morning, Mr. Sangfroi accuses the driver of scratching the Mercedes, which I happen to be 100% certain he himself did the other night when he came home blind drunk at dawn and almost demolished the gate. So the driver stormed off just before he was supposed to leave to pick you up, and then Ray stormed off too, to God knows where. Plus, the place has been crawling with just who you want to hang out with, accountants. Well, one of them's a lawyer, and I think there's an engineer too. They look like triplets, or maybe it's quadruplets. Hard to tell how many of them there are. They're Ray's guys, his pets. A week ago, they were golden, guaranteed to go for the throat. Now, all of a sudden, they're a heap of sloths who just lounge around swilling his wine and hogging up his food, which, big surprise, and he fucking well better be back for dinner because I'm not entertaining those turnip heads. Don't worry, you'll be okay, though. Amos Voinovich is here, too, except he's pretty antisocial, which I didn't really get until he showed up. And it turns out he hates the beach. Anyhow, he's better than nothing. Amos Voinovich, the puppeteer? Well, I mean, yeah. You know him? I didn't know him, but I'd seen one of his shows, which was about two explorers and their teams. There were puppet penguins and puppet dolphins and puppet dog sleds and, of course, puppet explorers fighting their way through blizzards and under brilliant starry skies to be the first to get to the South Pole. Voinovich himself had written the lyrics and the music, and each explorer sang of his own megalomaniac ambitions, and various dogs from each team sang about doubts, longings, loyalties, resentments, and so on. And the penguins, who knew very well that one explorer's team would prevail and flourish, and that the other explorer's team would die down to the last man, sang a choral commentary, philosophical in nature, that sounded like choirs of drugged angels. Krista chucked my suitcase into the trunk of her car, and as we sped upwards on winding roads in the brilliant sunshine, the deluxe night of Amos Voinovich's puppet show wrapped around me. And while Krista groused about Ray, I kept dozing off, which was something I'd not been doing much of for a very long time, and her voice was a harsh silver ribbon glinting in the fleecy dark. We came to an abrupt stop in front of a smallish house covered with flowering vines. This is where you and Amos are, Krista said. You'll be sharing a kitchen, but I mean nothing else, obviously. Accountants, I said, stumbling out of the car. They're staying in the main house with us, unfortunately. Ray insisted, although we could perfectly well have given them a bungalow. You'll see them at dinner, but except for that, you won't have to deal with them. They're all taking off tomorrow. She brought me into the little house, which was divided in two, except, as she'd said, for a kitchen downstairs, although meals and snacks and so on would always be available in the main house. Dinner was early, she said, at 8, and no one dressed except once in a while if someone happened to be around. Did I have any questions? I gaped. Guess not, I said. Come on over whenever you want, she said, and gave me a quick, squeamish hug. So, welcome. What was not dressing? I opted for jeans, which were mostly what I'd brought, and when the clock on the night table informed me that it was 7:45, I went over to what I assumed was the main house and wandered through empty rooms until I happened upon Krista, who was wearing a little vintage sundress the color of excellent butter. Dinner meant helping yourself from a selection of possibilities and then sitting down at a long polished table that probably seated 30. Amos, the puppeteer, did not, in fact, show, but the accountants, or accountants plus lawyer plus engineer, were there. They didn't wear jackets, but they all wore exhaustingly playful ties, which suggested, I suppose, that Ray's forthcoming acquisition was so sound that chest-thumping frivolity was in order. Ray had reappeared and said hello to me, giving me a bitter little smile as though he and I were petty thugs who had just been flagged down by a state trooper. And that was the last notice of me he took that evening. I watched through the glass wall as evening slowly began to rise in the bowl of the valley below and soft lights glimmered on. The soft mauve twilight currents were rising around the table, and somewhere in that gently swirling dusk, the accountants were talking among themselves, telling jokes, it seemed. Their bursts of raucous laughter sounded like reams of paper being shredded. And after each burst of laughter, they would instantly sober up and swivel deferentially around to Ray. What language are they speaking? I whispered to Krista. You really better drink some water, she said. It was English, I realized. But specialized. One of them was finishing up a joke that seemed to concern a pilgrim, a turkey, a squaw, and something called credit swap rates. They all laughed raucously again. Ray was drumming his fingers on the table, making a sound of distant thunder, and he stood up abruptly. Gentlemen, he said, with a tiny bow, I have a great deal to gain from this transaction, but if at 0 hour by some mishap it should fall through, let me remind you that owing to the billable hours clause you were so kind as to append to our contract, only you will be the losers. I salute your efforts. I have the highest hopes, for your sake as well as mine, that your irrepressible confidence in them is justified. But perhaps a moment of sobriety is in order at this point, a moment of reflection about the tenuous nature of careers. Or, to put it another way, don't think for a moment that if the boat is scuttled, I'll throw you my rope. I'm sure you all recall the Zen riddle about the great Zen master, his disciple, and the duck trapped in the bottle. He drained his large glass of wine, glug, glug, glug. Everyone recall the master's lesson? It's not my duck, it's not my bottle, it's not my problem. He slammed his empty glass down on the table and wheeled out. What did I tell you? Krista said. What did she tell me? I had no idea. Presumably, I'd been dozing at the time, soaring aloft on polar winds as the two explorers savagely pursued their pointless goal under the remote, ironically twinkling stars. Plus, she said, I think he's seeing someone here. Oh, wow, I said. And I thought of how rapidly an individual's beauty and glamour could be supplanted by some girl who was just about to walk through the door. Oh, wow, I said again. You can say that again, she said. The accountants, etc., had disappeared from the table, I realized. All that was left in their place were crumbs. Upstairs in my bedroom, I began to unpack, but I was listing as though I were drunk, which I suppose I was from all the wine it had seemed appropriate to toss down at dinner, but mainly I was exhausted, though still wide awake as I was so often, wide awake and thinking about things I couldn't do anything about. Couldn't do anything about. Also, an unfamiliar, somewhat rhythmic tapping suggested that there might be a beast right outside my window trying to get me to open it and let it in. To account for my snoozing in the car, I'd mentioned to Krista my exasperating resistance to sleep, and just before we sat down at the table, she gave me a few pills wrapped in a Kleenex. What are they? I'd asked. They're rays, she said. He won't notice. A few months back, I'd gone to a doctor about sleeping problems, and he'd asked if I wanted pills. I'm afraid they'll blunt my affect, I said. He looked a little disgusted, as if to remind me that he had a downtown practice, and I was not the first self-obsessed hysteric he dealt with that day. Then your best bet is to figure out why you're not sleeping, he said. What's to figure out? I said. I'm hurtling through time, strapped to an explosive device, my life, plus it's beginning to look like a photo finish, me first or the world. It's not so hard to figure out why I'm not sleeping. What I can't figure out is why everybody else is sleeping. Everybody else is sleeping because everybody else is taking pills, he said. So I got a prescription from him, and I took the pills for about 5 nights running and flushed the rest down the toilet. They got me straight to sleep all right before I'd even had a chance to boot up the worries, and I would sleep for hours and hours, but then I would wake completely exhausted, and in the morning when I'd get to work painting, I seemed to be sloppier or less demanding than I'd formerly been. Maybe my painting wasn't any worse than it had been, but I sure didn't mind enough that it wasn't better. I heaved my suitcase onto a luggage rack to get it out of the way of bugs, even though if there were bugs, I'd probably brought them along in my suitcase and listed on my feet again. I needed to hydrate, probably, I thought. So I went downstairs to the kitchen to search for water. A bony little person wearing a red and black checked shirt and skinny red and black plaid pants was sitting at the table, regarding me with huge black eyes that looked as though they were rimmed with coal. He had a lovely, large, downward curving nose and a face so waxen and intense in its penumbra of black curls that it left an afterimage. Am I disturbing you? He said. Not yet, I said. I mean, we've hardly met. The noise, he said. Spread out in front of him on the table were scraps of fabric and colored paper and little figures made out of clay and wood and some tools, including a little hammer. Hey, I said, I loved Terra Nova dreaming. I really did. Good, he said, because I could use your opinion on this new one. It's gotten pretty out of control. There are a lot of characters, including some bats, that have to turn into drone aircraft and back again, which is a pretty tricky maneuver. I don't want to take too much of your time, though. Krista told me you were coming, and I figured you wanted to get your own stuff done, or why else would you be here? Well, I said, I mean, to relax? Yeah, you must have a pretty unusual relaxation technique going. Why do you... Hey, he said, even some of the world's champ relaxers didn't show this season, haven't you noticed? The whole crowd is bailed. All the other freeloaders and the usual apparatchiks. I'm here because I got evicted from my apartment when the arts program at the school where I was teaching got cut. And what with putting the new show together and not exactly having an income, luxury handouts were definitely attractive, whatever the hidden costs. I figured you were coming for some similar reason. Anyhow, the onus is on us, obviously. The onus? The onus, he said, to entertain, to distract, to diffuse, to buffer, on us, as in on you and me, which is why I hardly ever put in an appearance at the main house. And as I established the policy immediately, it's been interpreted as a sign of genius. I suggest that you adopt my example ASAP, in fact, as things are clearly just about to get worse. I'm kind of way behind you, I said. Huh. He looked at me with a blend of interest and distant pity. Two things, he said, and he started in, quietly but implacably, like a fortune teller laying out the pitiless cards. That can't be true, I said when he trailed off. Is all that true? Have a look, he said, see for yourself. So I went to the window, and sure enough, off in the distance were bobbing lanterns, and I could see a small line of people straggling down a dirt road toward the water, hauling little carts piled with bundles of stuff. They wait all night for the boats, he said, sometimes longer. Apparently, most of the people in the area had lived for centuries by working little farms, but a few years earlier, there had been relentless rain, and the flooding had washed out the crops. And then there was a second year of that. The third year was a drought, and so was the next one. So none of the new planting could establish roots, and it all blew away. People were exhausting their stores of food, but then Ray bought up lots of the farms, which, under the circumstances, he got at a very good price. And instead of planting grain or vegetables, he planted eucalyptus, which roots really fast, as a cash crop and to keep the bluffs from collapsing. So everyone was happy for a while. But in the summer, there had been a few lightning storms, and the high oil content of the eucalyptus was graphically demonstrated when they burst into flame, burning down homes as well as whatever crops were still being grown by anyone who hadn't sold their land to Ray, and food prices were skyrocketing. So naturally, local people who could leave were leaving, and a lot of the foreigners, like Ray and Krista, who had places in the area, were pulling up stakes too. So that's thing one, Amos said. Thing one, I said. And thing two is that Zofran has rented a place a few miles just up the coast. That's where I'm going to stop. That's thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I guess if anyone would like to ask a question, I would love to respond to it. there is a question.
Hi, your dialogue is amazing. Do you have any tips for writers in the audience about how to write incredible dialogue like that?
Well, thank you very much. I just really enjoy doing it. I don't really think that there's any technique for it. I think that probably the best way to do it is just to sort of have fun. I mean, just put some people inside your head and hear them talk and have fun, and then cut out the bits that don't do what you need them to do. But don't get hung up trying to restrict yourself to forcing it to convey the information that you need, that you can get to that. Just let them roll. That's my only tip. Other useless pieces of information? Oh, good.
You prefer short fiction. Do you prefer it?
Do I prefer?
And why do you choose to do that instead of the longer variety?
Well, I would say that I love to read both short fiction and long fiction, anything else that's available. I do love the elegance of short fiction. I love it that, I mean, of course, there's all kinds of short fiction. There's lousy short fiction, too. But to me, good short fiction has all the depth that anything can have, but is very, very compressed, very layered, and I find it quite exciting to read. Sometimes it's a little demanding, but it can be very adventurous almost kind of an adventure, because the reader is in a kind of dialogue with the author. It really it requires a certain amount, and I love the beauty of compression. I wouldn't say I exactly chose to write it. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy to write anything. As I mentioned, I do write a kind of eccentric length. It's long for short fiction. I would love to be able to go shorter. I have never found myself able to. Everything is the same sort of bizarre, anomalous, unpublishable length. I mean, of course, if I happen to write a novel, I'm not going to throw it in the trash. I'll be very pleased. But I've never set out to write one, and I've never set out to write anything in particular. Everything always just kind of turns into the same length.
Your first-person narrators often seem to be sort of bemused by the bad behavior of the other characters. I wonder if this is a pattern that you see and that interests you.
I hadn't actually ever thought of that, but of course, it is a lot of fun to watch bad behavior, so probably that's just translated itself to the page. But also, there's something very satisfying about a kind of naive narrator, because you're working then from somebody who's seeing afresh, seeing without prior interpretation. And that, of course, gives you a lot of room on the page to scrape away cliches. It is fun.
When you teach, which authors do you like your students to read, and why?
Oh, this is my brother who has asked the most difficult possible question. I do teach. I tend to teach writers who are dead, frankly. But largely because I think my students won't have encountered their work. They read a lot of contemporary work and not so much the work of the past. I like to teach things that I consider spectacular accomplishments, really, really great examples of short fiction, because it's easy to say what's wrong with something, and that's not so interesting to me. And it's difficult to talk about why something is good. That's very difficult to talk about. You really have to think about what is this? What is this thing? And that's what I want them to do. We read short fiction not because I write it, but because it's short, so that my students can read each piece several times. I want them to go slowly. I want them to look at every sentence. I want them to look at word choices, at punctuation, at details. And some people that we often read, I have a former student here whom I love, Margaret Meyer, writer, and she was reminding me that when she was in my class, we had read Heinrich von Kleist, really great story, The Earthquake in Chile, really, really great story. This semester, I read a great Faulkner story with my students, a Joyce story, some of the usual suspects. We're reading some Mavis Gallant, Catherine Mansfield, Isaac Babel, always. That's a representative sampling.
It's so satisfying to read and hear a funny story well told. How much of your humor comes naturally to you and is part of your natural voice, and how much do you consciously use it as part of your craft?
I can't even be said to have a conscious mind. when I'm writing, I'm just sort of scribbling away there. The brain comes in at a very late stage. I don't really set out to make anything either funny or unfunny. But sometimes, like this person's voice just came as a little present to me, and she just went merrily along. But I, Yeah, I would say that I don't even, if somebody tells a joke, I'm the last person in the room who understands it. I'm always sort of saying, what was that about? So in a way, I don't even have a sense of humor, let alone a conscious mind. I'm not sure if that addressed your question.
Do you do rewriting? Do you start with a character and then find that it's too verbose or not enough of other details coming in? And how do you do rewriting?
Yeah, I do almost nothing but rewrites. It takes me a very, very, very long time to write something. It's a year is about standard for writing a story for me. I'm extremely slow. And it takes me, I would say, I don't, to continue from the prior question, I really don't start with ideas. I've never had an idea. I'm just depending on one to eventually emerge from what I'm doing. I rewrite, and I would say that that stage where the brain does come in for me very, which is very, very late, yes, then I, of course I'm always evaluating, is the character consistent? Is the narrative consistent? Does something need to happen that I've neglected? But I would say for me, the essential problem is at a certain point, way, way far into the process, when I think I've really written the final draft, there's almost always a moment when I think, but why did I write this? What was I interested in? And often, if I can't find the title, if I'm having trouble finding a title, I know that I don't really, something is unfocused. And at that point, I have to really find what is essential, what it was that really was driving it, what is the inescapable heart of it, and that's when I do the actual final draft and all the relationships are slightly changed. I mean, the scope, the scale, everything changes slightly at that point.
What would you say has helped you improve most as a writer?
Time. I think it's incredibly important to read, but I think a weird combination of sort of a patience with oneself, and also a demandingness. It's an odd combination. I think writing is filled with strange paradoxes. Like, I suppose everybody has an image in her or his mind of the sort of lazy writer who is just always hanging out at cafes or something. Well, as my wonderful sweetheart, who is also a writer, and without whom I would never have started writing, once said to me, well, the good thing about writing is that whatever you're doing is work. And and it's true. You're always working. But that, the fact is, it's what really helps is just doing it. There are no more. Oh, wait, there.
In your writing, you have amazing sensory detail. What are some tips that you would say to other writers to have better sensory detail?
Sorry, I couldn't even hear that, even with the mic. I'm sorry, I have terrible ears.
You have amazing sensory details in your story. What are some tips that you would give to other writers to have better sensory detail?
I would say that your senses, I mean, just look, use your eyes, use your ears, and always think, you know, well, what does it really look like? What does it really sound like? What does it really feel like? And the first answers that your mind is going to dish up to you, your first response is probably going to be something sort of familiar, something that's sort of a cliche, but what any writer has to offer is an individual psyche, you know, just an individual personness. And I think that you'll find, if you really let it operate, what does that look like to me? You'll come up with something quite accurate and unusual. That's the only advice I have to give about that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jana Malamud-Smith, and I want to join the Penn Faulkner Penn Malamud committees in welcoming you tonight to this really wonderful, funny, great reading. And I also want to thank the Penn Malamud committee, particularly always Deborah Tannen, but everyone on the committee for all your hard work that makes this award possible. At the beginning of his memoir, Fall Out of Heaven, Alan Shoes describes his father's funeral and how at the cemetery, almost as he was tossing dirt onto the casket, he hears his father's voice admonishing him to go visit the family home. Quote, that little desert outpost in Uzbekistan where I spent my best youth, and I'll meet you there and we'll see what happens next. And so in 1986, Alan and his son Josh buy plane tickets and fly to the Soviet Union to find out what might happen next. As many of you know, Alan died this past summer, and while I make no claims to hearing his voice, I do want very much to note the presence of his spirit this evening at this event. Alan, who at various times chaired and sat on the Penn Malamud Committee, read prodigiously, day in, day out, for decades. And the award owes much to his labor and to his devotion to his craft. He knew his contemporary fiction, and he knew a lot of writers. Alan was a young teacher at Bennington College when he met my family, and he became and remained a good friend to my father and later to my mother. I am grateful to be here tonight to be able to give an award that has benefited so particularly from his loyalty to them. Alan mostly wrote fiction, and whether we take as fact or fiction his dead father's invitation, it offers us a summons. It also asks an essential reading question. What should we do when people call from the grave to invite us on journeys? Miss Manners has not weighed in. But often, a wise approach is to read on to find out what might happen next. Only in books can we hear in such detail from the dead and, of course, from the living. Only in books can we encounter other minds, other badly messed up and yet extraordinary cauldrons of fact and fantasy, memory and desire, grief, love, rage, madness, envy, satiation, discovery, and remorse. Minds revealed with sublime precision. Only in books can we experience so particularly the invitation of the mysterious summons, the pull toward adventure, and toward that contradiction of being able to stay seated on one's sofa and yet travel through time and space into another person's sensibility, or at least, as Deborah pointed out, as we interpret that sensibility. With Alan's death, I find that the past when my father prospered now feels further past, the time when he loved nothing more than to sit at a dinner with friends like Alan, one graced by my mother's Italian cooking, not to mention her own astuteness as a reader and observer. So many animated dinners, talking over the local college scene in the larger literary world, the matter of what new novels or story collections were worth reading, what ones not. Talking too about the nation and about political strife, and then leavening it all by telling jokes, usually Jewish, usually a little edgy. I say edgy because I can't quite find the right word. Alan and Dad both relished telling jokes. With Alan's death, I am reminded how the people we love are kept in the world by our common witness, and each time someone else who cared about them dies, they recede further. Still, their books remain. We can open them and see what happens next. In a recent public conversation between President Obama and Marilynne Robinson, the president puts the miracle of books simply and well. Reflecting on the important stuff he's taken from reading fiction, he observes, it has to do with empathy, and it has to do with being comfortable with the notion that the world is complicated and full of grays, and there's still truth there to be found. It's a commonplace, but yet one worth reabsorbing, that the greatest fiction offers us cascades of gray impressions, subtle, nuanced, contradictory, paradoxical, sometimes terrible, sometimes funny as hell, that move us as they rearrange our mental landscapes, expand our given world, and offer back to us the voices of our individual and collective compatriots living and dead. How remarkable. How lucky we are. It is in the appreciation of her writing gift and in acknowledgement of her most accomplished participation in this marvelous realm of words, specifically in short story writing, that it gives me such pleasure tonight to give the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story to Deborah Eisenberg.
Thank you now. As Richard said to start the evening, Enormous thanks to the Malamud family for gracing us with your presence, and to Jana for gracing us year after year with extraordinary insight. I personally remark each year that you managed to say something so beautiful and thoughtful and new about your father's legacy and about this prize. It's really something special. So to the Malamud family and to Deborah Eisenberg for your extraordinary body of work, thank you for gracing us with your presence tonight and with your text. To all of you, thanks for being here, and please join us in the Great Hall for wine and cheese, and Deborah Eisenberg will be signing books. So we look forward to seeing you there.
The Penn Faulkner Foundation is grateful for the support of our reading series underwriters, Hill's Kitchen, Key West Literary Seminars, Sonoma Restaurant, Tupelo Press, and the Writers Center in Bethesda, Maryland. We're also thankful to the Folger Shakespeare Library, and for this particular event, to Sonoma again and to Green Hat Gin, made at the New Columbia Distillery in Washington, D.C. And of course, we're grateful to you, our listeners. To find out more about Penn Faulkner, visit us online at www.pennfaulkner.org, and to help us keep bringing our high-quality programming to readers in D.C. and beyond, donate at www.pennfaulkner.org/support.